Okay, well, the topic for this morning is smart biosecurity science. Australian agriculture, don't risk it. Well, it certainly has been an exciting few days for biosecurity. Just ask a certain fictional pirate captain. It's an issue that doesn't seem to cross the average person's mind unless they're at the airport queuing up for customs and wondering whether they left that wooden carving in their baggage or not. But on Monday, thanks to a certain Hollywood couple, the entire nation and parts of the Western world are now very familiar with Australia's biosecurity regime, at least when it comes to overseas travellers. And that brings me to this morning's guest. Mick Keogh is an executive director at the Australian Farm Institute, an organisation that seeks to establish policy agendas with the ultimate aim of benefiting farmers. In February, Mr. Keogh was appointed the part-time agricultural commissioner for the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, which has already gotten active recently in the beef industry via a market study. Mr. Keogh grew up in a farm in southern New South Wales. He holds both a bachelor and a master's degrees in agriculture from the University of New South Wales. He's worked as a farm manager, a university researcher, an agribusiness consultant, and an agricultural lobbyist and policy advisor. So we're all very glad to have him here to speak about biosecurity to us, and I'd welcome Mr. Keogh to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I thought he was going to compare me with Johnny Depp, who I know has been voted the sexiest man alive. And I guess he pulled up short of that comparison. Thanks very much for the opportunity to talk this morning. I think this issue is quite important and getting more and more important for a number of reasons, and we'll talk about those. Purely coincidentally, yesterday there was a tweet from the Federal Department of Agriculture, and it explained that its staff were currently overseas examining a particular biosecurity threat, Xylella fastidiosa, which is known under different names in the US as Pierce's disease or sharpshooter's disease. And the tweet had a link to this disease, and it spelled it out. So it's native to the Americas, spreading around the world with recent detections in Italy and France, Caribbean, Taiwan, Iran, Turkey, Lebanon, Kosovo, and some unconfirmed reports in India and Morocco. It affects a range of important native commercial and ornamental plants, native trees and shrubs, wine and table grapes, citrus, olives, nuts, almonds, pecans, stone fruit, avocados, blueberries, coffee, lucerne, forestry, and amenity shrubs and trees. Currently, no treatment options. Once a plant's been infected, it'll eventually die. There's no evidence of Xylella being successfully eradicated once it's been established. It's spread by human-assisted movement of assisted plant propagated material and transmitted by insect vectors, which spread to other plants. And evidence from Australian, from overseas is that many of the sucking insects already present in Australia are expected to be vectors and able to spread this pathogen should it be introduced. And if it were to establish in Australia, it would, according to reports, would devastate many of Australia's agricultural industries, in particular the grape and wine industry, and it is estimated that an outbreak would amount to a cost of about $4.2 billion over 20 years. So I thought that was interesting in the context of the discussion this morning, because that particular issue and that particular biosecurity threat brings in all the factors that have been identified in some recent CSIRO work about the relevance of and changing nature of biosecurity risks for Australia. So increased tourism. In fact, increased tourism entries in regional areas, so airports like Cairns, Toowoomba, Canberra, etc., that are quite close to production areas. Increased agricultural trade. We've seen the signing of free trade agreements, which brings enormous benefits, but also brings with it incredible increases in the amount of trade. which of course goes both ways. Milder winters, if we end up with milder winters, the insect vectors that would transmit that particular disease persist for longer, and therefore the spread becomes more of a risk. And increased agricultural intensification, a lot of common production systems all close together, and creating the opportunity for those diseases to spread rapidly. But then in Australia we've got some additional risk factors, and I think we're sort of familiar with those, but it's worth bringing those to mind as well. So we've got steadily diminishing state government agriculture and biosecurity budgets and capacity. So most of the on-the-ground work in relation to biosecurity, but also a lot of the biosecurity R&D, has typically been the ambit of state governments. But of course, we see state by state, almost in a domino effect, them progressively removing the resources and the capacity, and that is creating some real issues. University agriculture faculties that are shrinking and or disappearing. So we're not seeing those centres of knowledge and research capacity in anywhere near the same way that they used to be the case. The challenges associated with securing collaboration and resources for cross-industry research activities. So particularly in a case like Xylella, where you've got multiple different commodities involved, everything from pasture right through to horticulture and amenity horticulture, one of the challenges with the Australian system is that we tend to have our research capacity and funding in commodity groupings, and that makes it quite difficult to get common action or even a common agenda on particular issues that cut across all the different commodities. I've already mentioned free trade agreements is an additional risk factor, and especially the associated technical protocols. So under a free trade agreement, the headline is good, but then under that you have to have the technical agreements that identify, for example, if we claim to be free of a particular disease, what are the standards and protocols we apply to make sure that that freedom status is appropriate, because of course the trading partner, who in future is not going to have any restrictions in terms of tariffs or quotas, wants to be sure that if we claim we're free of this particular disease, we have some basis for making that claim. And I think that is one of the main things that's changed. And it's interesting, we've had delegations here recently from places like China saying, well, you claim you're free of this disease, demonstrate the testing or the protocols or or the surveillance that you've used to demonstrate that. And of course, if we say, well, we no longer have a public sector agency that has staff on the ground and able to detect these diseases, that claim gets harder and harder to make. So we've moved from an environment where we could claim that we're free of disease because it hadn't occurred, to one where it's increasingly going to be, we'll prove you're free of the disease rather than just make that claim. So I think that is something that's probably sitting in the background that we haven't thought much about. And I guess the other thing that's very evident is that Australian agriculture is increasingly moving into a premium position in markets. The obvious case is baby powder into China, where our freedom from disease and our food safety standards put our products at a considerable premium to competitor products in the market. Even the case of Indonesia, for example, where our cattle are accepted there, but cattle from Brazil and Argentina aren't because of their disease status. So that is great from a farmer's return perspective, but it actually ratchets up the risk associated with a biosecurity incident, because if that biosecurity incident does arise, the fall, if you like, from that premium position to being locked out of access to that market is a much bigger hit than was the case in the past, where Australian products didn't have such a premium. So all those factors are contributing to a situation where the biosecurity requirements in Australia are becoming more and more important. And I guess the multi-billion dollar question is, what can be done to minimise those risks? As I said, there's some very real questions about whether we've got the ability to manage an incursion once it occurs. If we don't have public sector agency personnel on the ground, will, for example, an advisor, an agronomist to a cropping enterprise, or an advisor to a beef enterprise, blow the whistle if there's the potential of a disease there, when in fact it's one of their clients, and of course they're important in terms of revenue. So moving away from the public sector having boots on the ground, if you like, to one where we're relying on private sector advisors creates that risk, and I don't think we've thought through how that can be better managed. The other point I think is quite important here is that if you go back through the history of biosecurity and the various reviews that have occurred, the Beale and the Nan review, they all pointed to the fact that simply thinking you can stand at the border and stop stuff is basically not going to work as all these factors change. So increasingly, it's pre-border risk assessment that is important. So that means going to places like Indonesia and China and all our trading partners and being on the ground and understanding the nature of the risks and the diseases that are evident there, so that we can make judgments about whether or not those products are suitable to import into Australia. But the challenge there is if we haven't got the technical capability and the technicians and the scientists that are conversant in all the various disciplines that are associated with biosecurity, microbiology, all those sorts of things, then that's very difficult to do, very difficult to be credibly involved in and engaging with other nations if we can't demonstrate that capability. So all those issues, I think, are bringing us to a point where there really does need to be some serious thinking about how we manage the future of biosecurity in Australia, and associated with that, of course, the future of biosecurity R&D, because we tend to think of research and development as a separate bucket from, for example, the operations of a biosecurity system at the border or on the ground. The reality is, of course, that the scientists that are trained and get their experience through the R&D system, through involvement in research project, become the technical experts and the knowledge experts that are essential to maintaining a good biosecurity system into the future. So without the PhD students taking up projects that involve investigation of these issues, we don't end up with a generation of experts who can adequately manage biosecurity into the future. So there is a risk in thinking about R&D as a separate part rather than a continuum in terms of the future of biosecurity. That brings us to the Plant Biosecurity CRC and its predecessor. So since 2005, the Plant Biosecurity Cooperative Research Centre has invested about $250 million in plant biosecurity research across the spectrum. It's been a coordinated research program. It's involved partnerships with state governments, with industry, with the federal government, and it's been a very good model. But those of you that are familiar with these issues would know that cooperative research centres have a finite life, typically in the region of about 7 years. And certainly in 2018, the current plant biosecurity CRC will disappear. So the relevant question for industry is what happens in the future with plant biosecurity research in Australia? What is the future of that? The options we spelt out in a discussion paper there range from, for example, do nothing. Assume that the states and the research and development corporations that have an interest in plants will devote sufficient resources to that and maintain capability and keep that research going. I think one of the problems with that is in many respects this research tends to be long-term and at the basic or early strategic level, and of course the benefits and payoffs from that tend to be slow rather than quick, and that tends not to attract research funding from some of the RDCs and the state governments, because it's a bit hard to demonstrate the relevance and the payoff. So The other problem with the do-nothing option, of course, is you lose that national coordination. You lose that ability to bring all the interested parties in a particular issue to the table and contributing to a particular issue rather than each of them separately playing in that area and perhaps not collaborating the way that they should. Another option is a new CRC. The problem with that is, it, as the Americans would say, it really amounts to kicking the can down the road. It will give another 7 years if it were successful, and that would be a stalling, if you like, of an ultimate decision, but it doesn't really solve the longer term problem of how to make sure there's adequate resources in this area. There is the potential to create a plant biosecurity research and development corporation under the PEARD Act. So that's the Commonwealth Act that creates the, for example, Grain Research and Development Corporation and other R&D corporations. That is a possibility. One critical weakness in that is it doesn't impose any requirements on the state governments to also be involved in supporting and resourcing these particular efforts. In fact, to the contrary, what happens is usually the state governments are the first to line up and seek the funding that might be available from that rather than continue to make a contribution. So while a plant biosecurity RDC makes some sense in some respects, I think the fact that the states aren't locked in and committed to resourcing that gives them a free out in some respects. Another approach is for the Rural Industries Research and Development Corporation to manage a program around, for example, plant biosecurity research and development. And the RIRDC does similar things for some of the smaller industries, for example, the rice industry or the honeybee industry, etc. I think the difficulty with that is that the scale of this type of area and the type of research here would in fact dwarf the activities of the RIRDC, and it would potentially create a situation where the board there, which is appointed for its expertise more broadly in rural issues, would not necessarily be appropriate to managing a portfolio of the scale and importance of the plant biosecurity challenge. And the final one is to create a plant biosecurity research corporation. So in other words, a standalone company funded jointly under an agreement between the state, the Commonwealth, the states, the Commonwealth and the industry, and committed to this particular area. Now some might groan and say, well, isn't that just creating another structure, another body that that farmers have to pay for? To some extent that's true. But the industry partners in that could well be, for example, the relevant current research and development corporation. So it may not necessarily mean additional funding, but rather more control and coordination associated with the funding of the existing RDCs as the industry partners. It could also involve the states with committed resources, so locking them in, and then the Commonwealth as a partner as it already is. And it's interesting that when you look at this model and say, well, yes, we can understand the rationale, but it's creating another one, it's a lot of negotiations, etc. It's interesting to me that in the last few years, our cousins across the Tasman have adopted this very model in their, what they call their GIAs. So their biosecurity agreements involve a corporate partnership, if you like, in a company between the various industry bodies and the New Zealand government, where each has a dedicated commitment of funding that they have to make available and a dedicated level of action that is required as part of their commitment to that company. So just when you think you've invented something new and here's a new concept we can think about, we look across the ditch and the Kiwis have been there for about 4 or 5 years. So I think that's the challenge that's in front of us. And some of you might say, well, what about animal biosecurity? I guess you could use the same arguments there. The focus here, because of the imminent demise of the plant biosecurity CRC, is in fact on the plant industry, and I guess that's where our focus has lied. But certainly the issue is a bit broader than that. So I guess the aim of the exercise is to put those options in front of industry, give industry plenty of time to think about that, and hopefully out of that will come a more coordinated and dedicated structure to manage this issue into the future, which I think everyone would agree is become more and more critical to the future success of agriculture in Australia. So with that, I'll leave you, and no doubt we'll engage in some discussion shortly. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mick, for that brief overview of a very complex and very important area of the agriculture industry. I'd now like to invite our other guests, Tanya Pittard from the Grain Producers Australia Group and Tanya Chapman from Voice of Horticulture, just to come up as well as part of our guest panel to answer some questions. So if you could welcome them, thank you. So does anyone have a question for Mick or Tanya or Tanya?
Mick or Tanya.
Sorry, up the bat.
Sorry, Graham Mitchell of Foresight. Mick, can you just draw out a bit more the merits or otherwise of a plant plus animal biosecurity research corporation, or keep them separate from the market? I missed at the end whether you keep them away from each other or eventually would have a biosecurity research corporation. What's your view?
We stayed agnostic on that for the time being. Some would argue that in fact the disciplines involved are not, at the technical level, are not necessarily common, and therefore there's not a great deal to be gained by having them together. Others would perhaps argue that, well, it's probably better than nothing. If both are left to wither on the vine, so to speak, you'll get nowhere, and maybe while industry may not be prepared to countenance two separate organisations, maybe at least one is a lesser of the two evils. So we didn't really get to the bottom of that. I think that's probably certainly something that needs thinking about.
I would have thought there's a high technical complementarity between the two in this day and age.
Yeah, there's probably better experts in the room to answer that than me, but certainly the first pass on it didn't necessarily come up with that, but might be wrong.
Perhaps one of our two other panel guests might have an input on that issue? Or you could come up and use this microphone while we try and get the other ones working if you'd like.
I've never been accused of having a quiet voice, so I probably don't need to. Look, I think when the state and federal governments and when the organisations were starting to put together the National Plant Biosecurity Strategy, I think they probably looked at that and agreed that at the minute you've got all of your pasture and your plants, and that fits into one area, and probably even your technical expertise. There's probably, and Charles, we've got our Chief Veterinary Officer from Victoria here, but you probably do still have that separation between the people who are experts in a lot of those animal diseases and then a lot of the work that's done in the plant. So I think when you're looking at something like that, small chunks, but also recognising that there probably is some very good rationale that's gone behind keeping them separate. And when you look at even the Intergovernmental Agreement on Biosecurity, but particularly that National Plant Biosecurity Strategy, they've obviously put a lot of thought into whether or not that needs to be a national biosecurity strategy or whether or not there's some very good reasoning behind keeping them separate.
Okay, Peter, you had a question?
Yeah, that's Rex. I don't believe many farmers realise the importance of biosecurity and understand the implications and the devastation and the cost it will lead to. So on the side of an incursion, I think we're heading in other parts of the industries around trying to develop QA systems to meet the demands of export markets and consumers and all that. Is there a possibility of bringing that biosecurity in as part of that? Because I know farmers particularly hate any regulation, any extra work, but I think the way markets are moving into the future and the protection of an industry overall, we need to deal with that. So thoughts on all of the above.
I guess in
Certainly, I appreciate Peter's comment about farmers hating regulation. I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, I think one of the challenges we face in the sector more generally is this premiumisation that's occurring. Okay, so in the probably in the bulk commodities markets like grain, it's less an issue, but certainly in the livestock industries, the horticulture industry, the high value horticulture industries, more and more you rely on accreditation and standards as a means of validating the quality of that product in the marketplace. That's typically administered at the ground level by specialist auditors. I think the challenge with that is they're not necessarily au fait with, for example, the particular indicators of disease or whatever. I guess they're at least someone on the ground who is visiting multiple farms who can see different situations evolving and perhaps report that. But I guess you know, the contrast between them and what used to be known as a district horticulture officer or a district veterinary officer, having that technical expertise to actually identify something and understand what the nature of the risk is. I think that's where we've moved away from. And I guess I'm not sure the thinking in terms of how we manage biosecurity into the future has also moved with that, because you know, we haven't got that technical expertise face-to-face on the ground anymore. So I'm not sure the QA systems necessarily would help us in that situation, other than perhaps an early indication that something looks like it's wrong, but that's about the extent of it.
As Mick said, you know, horticulture really does focus at a premium market, and you know, we do have a huge focus on the export market, and as such, I don't think there's an industry that doesn't have biosecurity as one of the top three things in its strategic plan. You know, so biosecurity is top of mind for all of us. But we are in horticulture also very aware that we have a dwindling amount of resources, and that resource comes in a number of ways. One is the dollars that we do have to invest into, you know, biosecurity, into market access, into a whole host of things. So knowing the importance of it and having the resources. So we've all seen over the last number of years the reduction in the amount of technical researchers that we now have, which is a huge concern to horticulture. So one of my biggest concerns about how we go forward is how do we put together everything that we have without necessarily increasing the cost of doing so. You know, good governance is one thing, but having three, four, five structures that all have a CEO, all have a board, whilst we have dwindling resources to do that. So we will never underestimate the need for good biosecurity. I think in horticulture, we are very fortunate that each of our growers do understand that they need to be vigilant and that they actually need to be looking at their trees, at their plants, at their fruit all of the time. Because, you know, as a citrus grower, having lived through canker and, you know, the cost of that, the ongoing effects of that, and seeing a grower locked out of being able to plant one single thing on their property for over 5 years is huge. So, you know, we do get that. One of the other things that I need to question is that we are very small in the terms of a global export nation as a player. How do we not collaborate more with what is happening by our overseas technical researchers? You know, Quanlongbing is something that, you know, threatens the citrus industry. And in California, they're spending $35 million per annum on research into that, you know, one pest disease that, you know, could very easily be here and wipe out the Australian industry. So how do we collaborate that and, as I said, make the most of the dwindling resources that we all have?
I'm going to take a slightly more on the ground approach, because, well, I was actually part of Exercise Haryana, which is still continues till August. So Exercise Haryana was about carnal bunch, which is not something you want to say three times fast after a glass of wine. And we all met up in Atwood in their fairly spectacular incident control centre, and we operated as if we'd had a notification that carnal bunch had been detected, and we knew the property, we knew where the seed had come from that led to that potential contamination, and then where do you go from there? And in the room there were plant scientists, there were representatives of the industry, there were representatives from the grain supply chain. And we started to have a look at exactly what you have to do, and then ultimately what the weaknesses were. It was an absolutely fascinating exercise because when you've got if it's detected on a farm where the grower has QA, the bonus is that the QA might not have found it, but the QA will mean you know exactly where each parcel of grain is, where it's going, which paddock it came from, and you can start to narrow your search parameters down. If it was found on a farm where the farmer didn't have good record keeping, things start to become a little bit more complicated. We sat there as an industry for an entire day working through as if we were sitting in an incident control centre. And some of the weaknesses we actually found that concerned GPA on behalf of Australian grain producers was that we don't actually have a national register of growers. So if something like this happens, it's actually really hard to find out exactly which farms, where, and how you actually get in contact with every farmer. We also don't actually have a good stocks reporting system. There's no transparency whatsoever about where any grain in Australia actually is, what qualities, what farms it's come from. And it's annoying enough from a market perspective not to have that stocks information, but from a biosecurity perspective, it's a massive concern, because if you actually had to put a halt on all grain movements, and if you had to be able to identify exactly where it was. And so for us, when we were sitting there with government representatives, we started to talk about that interaction between where you need more regulation, and if industry won't actually voluntarily have stocks reporting, it won't voluntarily get a really good national grower register that's available to government in the case of an emergency, that obviously becomes a legislative issue. And also then how you train agronomists to work, and also even how you train grain corp technicians and others so that they're looking for particular diseases. So I think this year is a really good year. We've had exercise Odysseus for the animal industries. We've had exercise Hariana for carnal bunch, for the grains industries. There are some really good on the ground work being done to actually say, how does our biosecurity function in a practical sense? What is the turnaround time for tests? What are the turnaround times for being able to prove that we're free of a disease? And some of those questions have been asked, and a lot of that information I think is going to come out this year when you talk about and you narrow down exactly what we're really good at and what we still have to work on.
Okay, I think we had the next in line was a question up the back there.
Hi there, my name's Bonnie Dwight from RIDES. Look, I just have a question about the formation of this new research organisation. Will there be any emphasis or focus on biosecurity for pastures or weed reduction, for example?
That certainly strikes you straight away that whilst typically the livestock RDCs, for example, have had an approach to pasture based around productivity, they probably haven't really been all that focused on pasture from a biosecurity perspective. And weeds then also become part and parcel of the broader biosecurity picture, and the extent to which that is also being managed or not managed at the state level, and whether coordination might benefit. So those two certainly could come into play in terms of what the scope of that future organisation might be, or indeed any of the options that are considered under the paper.
Just have a question at the head table.
Yep. So Charles Mill, Chief Veterinary Officer. Mick, firstly, can I say really good to hear. Likewise, I don't normally get accused of being quiet, but I'll use this. Really good to hear your views about the need for evidence-based claims. I think historically we're awfully guilty of not looking for something and then saying we're not having it, and clearly an absence of evidence is not an evidence of absence. So that's just a comment. But I want to really build on the point Tanya made and ask your views on the issue of traceability. So in Victoria we have an excellent system of traceability in cattle. We have a really poor system for sheep. We couldn't trace sheep. Similarly, by implication, what Tanya was saying, systems in the plant side are not maybe as good as they should be. What's your views about the importance of traceability and where we currently are?
Well, again, I think you can only consider that from the context of where Australian agriculture is heading. We're not going to be cost competitive against the South Americans and the Eastern Europeans, and you can all add it. There's a report coming out today about the advances Ukraine's making despite the political problems in terms of, for example, its grain production. So any thought that we could remain competitive on a cost basis against those nations is you should forget that straight away, because it's not going to happen. When we've got labour rates of $25 an hour and they've got labour rates of $2.50 an hour, it's pretty easy to work out what's going to happen. So that means we have to be focused on maintaining premiums, maintaining a quality or a safety advantage over those particular competitors in international markets. And straight away, traceability becomes a critical issue. For two reasons. One is obviously to be able to prove what you say is what you do, and you can guarantee that, but also more importantly that if an incursion does occur, if you cannot adequately trace the source and, for example, create a lockdown situation, a lack of movement situation, you then cannot move to a situation where you might want to declare zone freedom, for example. So, for example, where a disease becomes a problem in a particular region, if you can control the movement and you know that, you can create a zone there, and at least other parts of the country will not have access removed to the same extent. But if you can't do that, if you've just got an amorphous, it came from Australia, and no traceability associated with it, then that option of moving at least to a partial management of the impact of that incident becomes even more problematic, and you can't do it. So that traceability becomes the be-all and end-all, both in assuring of the quality, but also in managing the potential risks of an incursion, for example.
So I think in horticulture, because, as I said, we are really focused on export, that traceability is so crucial to us. So I don't want to keep referring to citrus, but as a citrus grower, if I was to get a call that there was something wrong with a piece of fruit of mine that sits in a market in China, I would be able to tell you exactly which part of my farm that came from. So, you know, that is all part of how we register to go into certain markets and how we must be passed by governments in those markets to actually send into it. And again, if I go back to the canker episode, which happened in Emerald, that was every citrus tree in Emerald was actually pulled out of the ground, and there was no movement in or out of citrus trees. And we too did the whole yellow dragon exercise, where we were locked in a room for 2 days to do the whole simulation exercise of what happens if HLV does get to Australia, and what are the strengths we've got, what are the weaknesses, how would we manage that biosecurity, and how would we stop the plant movement between the regions, between the states. So we actually have rules and systems in place now that actually prohibit us without a document transferring plants between our states and our regions already. So, as I said, you know, biosecurity is really top of mind and does need to stay there.
Okay, I think we had a couple of questions on that table.
Hi, I'm Sue Finger. I'm a grower and I'm also a director with Horticulture Innovation. One of the issues in your paper, Mick, is to do with funding. And you suggested perhaps we might look at a model which is a third. I see a really pressing issue in that we've got levies throughout the whole agriculture industry sunsetting, and we've got to do something by August 2017 to make sure that it keeps on the boiler. And that would be an issue with biosecurity, because I can't see industry players voluntarily giving money. Maybe I'm wrong, but I saw the situation with fruit fly in the PFA here in Victoria, and that was a bit of a disaster as far as getting voluntary contributions. But just interested as to how you think funding would go if we were to lose the levy system.
Well, I think you know the answer to that. That two elements to the levies. One is the fact that they do create some resources at a collective level, but the second is, of course, that they create leverage. So, in other words, the matching dollar for dollar from the Commonwealth, and also to the extent that it's possible, leverage from the states in that if they want access to some of those funds, there can occasionally be pressure brought to bear for them to bring some resources to the table as well. So I guess that's the real challenge. I don't know that we're proposing that in any of these models it may be necessarily additional resources, but rather that the resources are at least coordinated and directed in a strategic fashion rather than a bit piecemeal industry by industry. And I guess within HIA you've got that challenge anyway, and as you say, the fruit fly example is a classic one where no one collectively could agree that this was a priority that we all should work on, so divided they fell, so to speak. So, you know, I'm not sure that it necessarily means additional funding, but I guess we certainly all need to be aware of the reality that in the absence of this funding and the leverage that it brings, we are going to be into a future where these issues are going to become very, very major and potentially a bigger risk than anything else we can think of.
So I couldn't agree more. The sunsetting of the levies is a real issue across a whole host of issues, not just biosecurity. And if I could just go a little bit further, in my role as Chair of Voice of Horticulture, obviously I talk to all of the horticultural industries, you know, about where they're at with their levies and the investments that they do make. And I can tell you now that most of them are already committed out for the next 4 or 5 years, and to actually get an increase in the levy, so it's a very long process. It's like 3 to 4 years from the time you actually start, you know, going out there, the communications, the polling, and then if it does get passed by the minister, to have an increase. So at the moment, they're already stretching the levy that they have, including the match funding, across a whole host of priorities. And as I said before, most of them do have biosecurity in that top 1, 2, 3 of what their industry needs. So I really struggle as to how we are going to get industry growers to commit to the formation of another RDC. You know, an RDC is expensive to maintain. You know, if I look at HIA, about 15% of the budget is the management of that RDC. So for my, you know, way of thinking of how we have to better utilise our resources, we have to find a way to bring together the bodies that we've already got. Now, the reason the Voice of Horticulture came to be was the government said, we need to stop talking to a multitude of people. We need to talk to one voice, one person, you know, about all of the issues that come across horticulture that sit across us all. Obviously, we all have our own little special ones. So if we go down the path of setting up yet again another body, are we going to get pushback from the government because we have another body wanting to come in there, wanting to talk, wanting to have a slice of the pie? How do we get more people on the same page so that we have a really good, strong voice on biosecurity going into bat for us? You know, we have HIA that does research and development, coordinates all of that for horticulture. We have Plant Health Australia. You know, we have the work that CRC, you know, Plant Biosecurity has been doing. We need to find a way to have a much stronger voice for horticulture going into government on biosecurity than putting up more and more bodies.
I think GPA's position on levies has been very, very strong, and that's why we've been supporting the bill that's currently in front of the federal government to actually have levy pay databases and other things that actually make it easier to consult with farmers and to make sure that you can show their strong support for levies. I think we all know that if it's a voluntary levy, it's never going to happen and the funding just won't be there, and that would be a real shame for Australian plant industries. I think one of the benefits that you can already see through some of that national biosecurity strategy, so at the minute there's an agricultural senior officials committee that actually looks after that national biosecurity strategy. Plant Health Australia will be chairing that from the 1st of July. And they'll be looking at, I think at the minute, the national status report shows 550 biosecurity related projects in Australia at the minute. So there are 550 plant industry biosecurity projects that are, you know, got a range of funding parameters. They've got a range of industry organisations involved. There's some amazing research being done, and a lot of that research is supported by the RDCs and industry bodies, state and federal government. They are not all going to finish. by 2017. So maintaining and continuing those levies, it's just so, so important. And it has to be compulsory levies and everybody has to pay it. And even with compulsory levies, you still have, in the grains industry, traders who refuse to actually collect the levies and pass them on. So we'd be in a real mess if they weren't compulsory, and we'd be in a disastrous mess from a biosecurity perspective if they became voluntary.
Okay, we just had a gentleman at the back who's been waiting in line for a little bit.
Hugh Miller, biosecurity consultant. The focus of the review has been very much on R&D, but diagnostics is a critical part of biosecurity. And it seems to me in the plant biosecurity sector, the diagnostic capability we have in Australia for plant biosecurity is very much a part of the research environment. Far more so than in animal biosecurity, where there's probably much more dedicated diagnostic resources than we have ARL, a nationally resourced facility to look after our exotic animal disease diagnostic needs. So in your review, Mick, I guess it's a question for the panel, how much did diagnostics sit in your mind in terms of the best future model for R&D? Because either the two stay inextricably linked, and the future national resourcing and coordination of R&D has to work for diagnostics as well, or you try and separate them and take a different view, but which I don't think would be efficient. So have you thought about the diagnostics element? Because I see the plant sector as vulnerable at the moment in terms of diagnostics.
Yeah, look, I think you're right, Hugh. I think, and certainly if you go back to the NAN and the Beal reviews of biosecurity, they made the point that we get very excited about animal biosecurity and the risk of zoonosis, and I guess intrinsic human behaviour is that to see an animal suffering creates an emotional response and people don't want to see that. So when you look around the landscape in Australia, as you pointed out, we've put a lot of resources into animal biosecurity over time. We've got ARL, we've got that capability. When we look at the plant side of it, we don't seem to have that. I guess we have university faculties, some of which may have that. We've got perhaps the Wade campus in South Australia. But beyond that, you would ask that question. And I think you're right. I don't think you can separate necessarily the research from the diagnostics, because of course the technicians that end up in the diagnostics actually get their training by being involved in the research and so on. So I think that's one of the issues that whilst we didn't look at it in a great deal of detail, I think it does highlight why to assume the do-nothing approach and say, oh, well, we've got all these projects going, I think you're in risk of lack of coordination, for a start. In other words, wasting resources by repeating stuff that someone else is doing. But secondly, not creating that critical mass that allows you to make sure you've got all those capabilities covered on the way through.
One of the weaknesses we saw in Exercise Hariana was just the length of time it actually takes to diagnose Carnivore, because there's no quick diagnosis test. You can actually start to look at the structure of the organism and you can check it, but then to actually prove it's carnal bug, there's a much slower process of actually growing it. And that the lack of a quick diagnostic test for any of those very catastrophic biosecurity pests, plants, and or diseases is actually a problem. And that's something that, you know, when we were sitting in that room, that the CSIRO scientists, the agri-bio scientists who specialise in diagnostics, you could see them sitting there going, right, problem. It would take us 14 days to actually provide a temporary diagnosis. It would take us X number of days to provide conclusive diagnosis. Proving freedom is even harder, because we have a number of other types of bunts in Australia that are not carnal bunt, but look very similar. So it's those quick diagnostics tests are crucial.
I think the same can be said in horticulture. If we look at the recent episode of Panama 4 in bananas, you know, that could actually be sitting in the soil for up to 4 years. So, you know, you could go in and you could test farm after farm after farm and come back with a negative result. And then 2 days later, you could actually find that it is sitting there. And by that stage, you have no idea if the water flow has then spread that out. So, you know, that too is, you know, hugely evident in everything that we do. But, you know, we talk about the emotion of seeing an animal that's unwell. You know, any of you that have perhaps gone out and spoken with farmers when they're going through drought, when they're going through whatever, you know, if I go and talk to a citrus grower who is in fact pulling out all of his citrus trees, or the banana grower who now has to rip out all of his banana plants and go on to something else, the emotion is no less raw. So we have to find a better way of, as you say, coordinating everything, making sure that we're not complacent about the projects that are being done, but how do we bring it all together to ensure that, you know, we have that true biosecurity coverage that includes the technical, the diagnostic, all the way through.
I think you two are just arguing against your previous answers, but I'll leave it there.
Okay, well, unfortunately we're out of time, so once again I'd like to thank our three guests, Mick Keogh from the Australian Farm Institute and the ACCC, Tanya Chapman from Voice of Agriculture, and Tanya Pittard from Grain Producers Australia. Join with me in thanking them for coming out this morning.